Welcome to today's program, titled Enforcement of Non-Competes, Increasing Difficulty Depending on State. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by typing them into the text box on your screen. For those interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation that will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form. Please write this code down as it will not be reread and it is required for CLE credit. Copies of the webinar recording and the PowerPoint presentation will be distributed to the attendees in the days following the webinar. At this time, I would like to turn it over to Christine. You may begin.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us today on enforcement of non-competes, increasing difficulty depending on state. We think that this is an important topic and we're excited you're joining us. So for today, our agenda is to cover the following topics. So we're going to do kind of a general overview of restrictive covenants and their enforceability. Then we're going to look at new state legislation regarding restrictive covenants as well as proposed legislation in certain states. And then we're going to look at proposed federal legislation regarding restrictive covenants. So we're your presenters for today. I'm Christine Argentine. I'm a partner in Seyfarth Shaw's Chicago office. We also have Eric Barton. He's a partner in our Atlanta office. And then Kate Miller is an associate in our Chicago office. We regularly tackle this topic and advise clients and deal with litigations with respect to restrictive covenants. We would be happy to address any specific questions you guys have either during this webinar, if we have time at the end for questions and answers, or certainly feel free to contact us afterwards if you have specific questions regarding the state changes or restrictive covenants in general. Okay, so we're going to start with just kind of a very general overview of restrictive covenants and their enforceability. Obviously, restrictive covenants mostly include non-competition agreements and non-solicitation agreements. And the non-solicitation agreements are specific to, you know, former employees, not soliciting former employees, and not soliciting former customers that the former employee that's leaving the company worked with. These are restrictions that are generally enforceable, but blanket restrictions are disfavored because they're considered a restraint on a person's ability to work. So we advise our clients to be specific when you're looking at your restrictive covenants, when you're drafting your restrictive covenants. Oftentimes, courts and states require limitations such as time limitations, activity restrictions, geographic restrictions, customer restrictions. These types of things make the restrictive covenants specific enough that courts will, you know, look at them and find them to be reasonable. You know, it's important to consider tying the restrictions to specific products or specific services that that employee worked with or offered while they were employed. As far as non-solicitations, you want to consider limiting it to specific customers that that employee had responsibility for or significant information about or contact with, so that you are narrowly tailoring your restrictive covenants within specific to your industry, your company, so that the reasonableness of those restrictive covenants will be found by the courts if your restrictive covenants are ever challenged. The more narrow you can be while still protecting your customer, your employee, your company's interests, the more likely those restrictive covenants are going to be found to be reasonable. So keep in mind that reasonableness is going to vary greatly by the state you're in, and it's going to vary greatly by the particular facts of your situation, the industry you're in, the relevance of the confidential information, the type of customer your company is dealing with. So all of that is going to vary when a court is looking at enforceability. Some other provisions you want to make sure that you're looking at when you're drafting your agreements that contain restrictive covenants, you know, confidentiality and non-disclosure provisions are, you know, typically seen along with restrictive covenants. Provisions allowing for a company to seek injunctive relief in the event that restrictive covenants are violated. Attorney fees provisions are always important to have included in the event that a company has to go to court to enforce their restrictive covenants. Choice of law or forum selection clauses are something that we encourage people to consider when drafting restrictive covenants. Now, note that later in this presentation, you're going to hear some information about specific states where forum selection clauses and choice of law provisions are no longer, you know, acknowledged in those states or enforceable in those states, but we'll get to that those state-specific changes later on in this presentation. And then requirements that departing employees disclose their new employers during the non-compete or non-solicitation period. That way, if there is a violation of a restrictive covenant, there is a provision in your agreement that kind of allows you to be informed of that change and evaluate whether or not there might be a violation. So when we're looking at the enforceability of restrictive covenants, as I mentioned, it varies greatly by state. It's governed by state law. In general, states that enforce restrictive covenants require that the restrictive covenants be narrowly tailored to protect legitimate business interests of the company and contain reasonable limitations such as geographic restrictions, time limitations, customer restrictions, those types of things. So states are going to oftentimes define what legitimate business interests are either by statute or by case law. For instance, Missouri only recognizes two protectable interests, customer contacts and trade secrets. Beyond that, the restrictive covenants are, there are no legitimate business interests, and so those restrictive covenants would not be enforceable. Courts tend to analyze reasonableness of the restrictive covenant based on the specific factual circumstances. So what level did that employee have? What level of access did they have to confidential information? Are they a low-level employee? Are they an executive? What access did that employee have with respect to customers? How fast does the confidential information change in your industry? All these factors, and I'm sure you know there are many, many more, courts will look at in determining whether or not the restrictive covenants at issue are reasonable. Now, keep in mind that many, many states recognize what's called the blue pencil doctrine or judicial modification. So the blue pencil doctrine will allow a court to modify overbroad restrictions in order to make them reasonable. And some states don't recognize the blue pencil doctrine at all. And in those states, it will prohibit any modification. And to the extent that a restrictive covenant or a provision is found unreasonable, that entire agreement will be found unenforceable. But for states that do allow modification, there are two different constructions that are done. So the blue pencil doctrine is typically known as the strict construction, which only allows the court to strike out certain provisions or words in order to make those provisions or agreements enforceable. If the provisions require the court to rewrite them in order to make them reasonable, the court will find them unenforceable. So that's the strict construction. Other states follow what's known as the liberal construction, which is also known as judicial modification. And in those states, the court is allowed to revise the covenant in order to make them reasonable. So for instance, a court could change a two-year time limitation to a one-year time limitation. Courts often criticize the liberal construction because it kind of encourages employers to write very broad restrictions with the understanding that if a court finds it to be too broad, they will just revise it. So it is, you know, it's something that we don't encourage. We do encourage clients and companies to look at their restrictive covenants and try to make them as narrowly tailored as possible, understanding that they have business interests and confidential information that they do need to protect and that is the purpose of these provisions. So just to kind of briefly go over the enforcement options, when you have a violation of a restrictive covenant, typically the best way is to enforce that restrictive covenant is to get a court order. And that means filing a complaint, moving for a temporary restraining order, which is asking the court to enforce the restrictive covenant, bar the former employee from working for a competitor or soliciting customers or hiring employees, whatever conduct you need to stop that employee from doing. It typically also will include a motion for expedited discovery so that prior to the preliminary injunction hearing, you can collect all the information you need to determine whether or not that employee is actively soliciting customers or actively using confidential information. Another way to enforce and another thing to ask courts to do is to order an inspection of the former employee's computers and electronic devices in order to confirm that the employee does not have information that could be used to compete, that they didn't take any confidential information when they left. And then obviously we mentioned the attorney's fees provision. That's an important provision to have and something that you can use when enforcing your restrictive covenants to collect your attorney's fees back in the event that you have to go to court and enforce your restrictive covenants against a former employee. So I'm going to turn it over now to Eric Barton. He is going to start our discussion of kind of some state-specific legislation regarding restrictive covenants.
Great, thank you. There have been a lot of changes as we're going to go through state by state here, changes that have recently gone into effect, and actually a whole slew of changes to non-compete laws that are going to go into effect come January of 2020. So a lot of timely things to talk about. We're going to keep you on your toes. We're not going to go in alphabetical order by state, so bear with us as we bounce around a little bit. But we're going to begin up in the Pacific Northwest with some recent changes that are coming to Oregon. Oregon, as some of you probably are well aware, is already pretty stringent when it comes to non-competes. They are allowed. They're not prohibited, but the scope of them or what has to be done to apply a non-compete is pretty narrow, and as we're going to talk about in a second, getting more and more narrower. The focus is primarily by the legislature there to prevent low-level employees and employees that are paid what they deem to be a lower wage should not be bound by non-compete agreements. So up on the screen is the current law that is about to be modified a bit. But as you can see, there's sort of four main prongs to it. The first one, which catches a lot of people off guard that are new to the state of Oregon, but the non-competition agreement must be provided to a new employee in writing at least 2 weeks before the employee's first day. So the showing up, signing paperwork on the first day, and getting presented with a non-compete, it's going to be pretty much dead in the water then in Oregon, with a caveat we'll talk about in a second. And obviously, as you see in the fourth prong, there's a salary requirement that must be met in order for the individual to be burdened with a non-compete as well. The statute also makes it clear that a non-compete cannot exceed a period of 18 months. So that's the further boundary of it. There is a bit of an exception built into the statute where an employee who is not exempt and does not meet the salary test can still have a non-compete enforced against them. And it's sort of then driven, though, by the employer must take a sort of additional steps, and those steps being that they have to pay the departed employee at least 50% of that employee's annual salary and commissions at the time of termination, or 50% of the median family income for a family of four, whichever is greater. So a bit of a carve out if an employer realizes that they thought they had someone under a non-compete, but technically didn't. They then need to sort of pay to play if they want to have any attempt at getting that non-compete enforced. So a couple months ago on May 14th, the governor of Oregon signed House Bill 2992 into law. It goes into effect January 1st. And as the screen says here, this change keeps the current law in effect, but essentially adds another layer to it. And specifically, employers are now required to provide a terminated employee with a signed written copy of their non-compete agreement within 30 days of their termination date. And it, the statute now specifically will say failure to do so, even if it's enforceable for all the reasons and it's voidable and unenforceable. And the statute makes it clear that termination includes voluntary termination too. So even if the employer did not terminate the employee simply resigned, unless that employer proactively provides them with their written signed copy of their non-compete within 30 days, it's going to be void. And it's a big potential pitfall for folks to fall into. To that point, some have speculated that, you know, there may be a situation where an employee in Oregon says, well, I've quit, and then they try to tell their employer, well, they're rethinking their resignation and essentially dupe their employer into holding off providing them with their non-compete for 30 days. And in theory, there's no case law on it yet, but in theory, a trick like that might be successful if they could then show, the employee could then show they actually did indeed resign but weren't provided with a copy of their non-compete. It obviously becomes now imperative upon employers in Oregon to diligently keep copies of signed, executed copies of non-compete agreements. And those of us on the phone, practitioners and in-house counsel, I'm sure we've all run into this situation where we're pretty sure somebody signed a non-compete and we've got the unsigned copy of that non-compete that they signed, or maybe one that was signed by one party but not the other, and where the fully executed one went, we're not sure, but we know they signed it. In Oregon, based on the statute, it is going to be sort of the death knell for your ability to enforce it. So keeping diligent records, particularly over time, obviously individuals will often sign a non-compete and be with the company for many, many years. And if during the course of those many, many years that non-compete is lost, that could be a real problem in Oregon because it's got to be provided to them within 30 days of their termination. And which again is all the more reason for employers in Oregon or with Oregon-based employees to really have a strong policy in place and that HR is aware of, that they absolutely should provide copies of the signed non-competes really right away. There's no reason to wait until the 30th day. It should be provided right away and proof of the non-compete being provided to the employee would also be an excellent idea to take away a potential argument that the employee raises later on saying, well, they never provided it to me or they didn't provide it to me until the 35th day. So the more an employer can button up and prove when exactly the non-compete was provided to them, all the better as well. So that leads us into Washington. And Washington has a slew of significant new restrictions coming. Like Oregon, all of these changes are going to go into effect January 2020. And we're going to go through them sort of piece by piece, but this is, of the various states we're going to talk about, probably the one that has the most, or close to the most when it comes to changes to non-compete law in Washington. So first and foremost, and perhaps the most significant change is, under the current law and what Christine was talking about before in regards to judicial modification, Washington does have judicial modification. They can rewrite a clause to make it more narrow to be enforceable. And there's, as a result, and as Christine said, there's sort of little to no incentive for an employer to try to craft an agreement to be incredibly narrow if the court's going to just do it for them. But under the new law, there's actually a $5,000 minimum in damages plus attorney's fees and costs. So the $5,000 does not include any attorney's fees or costs. If a court or arbitrator needs to or chooses to reform or rewrite a non-compete to make it enforceable. And it is really going to put the burden on an employer to write, first off, write a non-compete that's going to be valid and probably even cause some to think twice about whether they want to take a shot at enforcing a non-compete that may or may not be valid, knowing that if the court needs to modify it to make it valid, they might get stung with a bunch of attorney's fees, and I'll obviously need to weigh that against the benefit of then getting the non-compete enforced. So a significant change. It should be very interesting to see how courts handle that and the type of damages they choose to award, as the statute just refers to a $5,000 minimum if courts on their own try to run that up or not. So an area to watch for sure in Washington. Washington is also adding income thresholds, sort of like to some degree like Oregon has already. It makes any non-compete agreement for an employee earning less than $100,000 or less a year invalid. If you're an independent contractor, you've got to get paid more than $250,000 a year to be valid. According to some notes, the original threshold was around $180,000, but lobbying efforts by some of the tech companies up there brought that down to $100,000, presumably to capture more folks to be in subject to a non-compete. But obviously the state's goal is to draw a line to keep quote unquote lower level or low level employees out of being burdened with non-compete agreements. Also sort of continued on the focus of protecting, again, quote unquote lower level employees, is an explicit permissibility for moonlighting, allowing low-level employees to moonlight. So as the slide notes, in situations where an employee earns less than twice the applicable state minimum hourly wage, which is $12 now, they can't be prevented from having an additional job or working as an independent contractor, being self-employed. That there is a caveat to that in the event the employer believes there's a safety issue or that they physically just can't do both jobs at once, and that they would be just too overburdened by a schedule that was too up in the air. But those exceptions aside, lower level employees are now sort of have a statutory right to have two jobs and not be prohibited from doing so by a non-compete. We now have time limits, 18 months, also like Oregon. So it's in this case, it's a presumption that any non-compete exceeding 18 months is unreasonable and enforceable. Again, a bit of a caveat to that. If the party seeking to enforce it can present, quote, clear and convincing evidence that they need longer than 18 months to protect their business or goodwill. But again, we'll have to see how the court interprets what constitutes clear and convincing evidence to meet that standard. And interestingly, just a 3-day limit for non-compete agreements related to performers, so singers and musicians. But I think because courts want them to be able to move from gig to gig. This is another very significant change in Washington as it relates to garden leave. And so in a situation in Washington where an employer lays off an employee, and this would only be if an employer lays off an employee, not where an employee chooses to leave on their own to go to a new job, but where they're laid off. If the employer wants to still hoist a non-compete on that employee who they laid off, they now have to provide compensation equivalent to the terminated employee's base salary at the time they were terminated through the period of enforcement. And as I know, less compensation earned through the other employment. So as you can see, I put an example on the screen here that if Mary is hired by Space Z at $100,000 a year but gets laid off 8 months later, and let's say she's subject to an 18-month non-compete but can't find any work outside of the space industry, unless Phase D continues to pay her $100,000 annual salary for the 18-month period, her non-compete will be invalid. So it's, I'm not going to use the word penalty, but obviously the legislature wanted to treat a situation differently where an employee chooses to leave on their own versus being actually laid off by the company, and then sort of salt on the wound is not only laid off, but then is burdened by a non-compete. So that's a statutory mandated garden leave that will be built in. Also, similar to what California has already, forum selection clause and choice of law clauses, Washington will not allow you to get around its new rules by simply saying another employee in Washington is subject to a non-compete under the laws of another state or has to litigate outside the state of Washington. Further attempt to make sure its residents are protected by its laws. It also has built-in disclosure obligations where employers must disclose the terms of the non-compete to employee in writing and no later than the time the employee accepts the offer of employment. So you got to be careful with that because it's at the time they accept the offer of employment, meaning if you extend an offer to an employee, tell them on a Friday, tell them to come in Monday to sign paperwork to officially become an employee, and you then present them with the non-compete agreement, it's not going to be enforceable. It's got to be presented to them. If the theory is that they have to know at the time they're accepting the employment and probably then quitting their other job, that they know that they're going to be subject to a non-compete agreement. So it's critical that it becomes part of the offer letter, if you will, and not just something for HR to handle when they come in to sign other paperwork when they become an employee. And Washington statute, as some other states have done, does make it explicitly clear that all these restrictions that we're talking to, which apply to non-compete agreements, do not apply to a non-solicit, a confidentiality agreement, a non-disclosure agreement, covenants related to the sale of a business, or covenants entered into by a franchise. So if you're dealing with any of those are their own separate beasts, but everything we've talked about is strictly in the context of a non-compete agreement. I'm going to cover one more state. Does not have nearly as much change as Washington, but some change in North Dakota. So in North Dakota, it is one of just a handful of states that bans non-competes outright by statute, and that has not changed. It's still the law in North Dakota. It also cannot be circumvented by a contractual choice of law provision where another state tries to get around North Dakota's law against non-competes in terms of a resident by simply pointing to another state's law. They explicitly have banned that. But it does contain exceptions for non-competes when they exist in the context of the sale of a business or dissolution of a partnership. So there, the legislature has recognized that a non-compete, if you're selling a business or you're dissolving a business, that you can have a non-compete. And for example, I cite a case there, even one for 5 years was deemed to be reasonable. And the legislature recently tweaked that exception a bit in this House Bill 1351, and it was essentially done to make a modification to the existing law as it relates to the sale of a business or when someone leaves a business that they have an ownership interest in. Again, it doesn't modify the general prohibition against non-compete provisions, but where the current law restricts a non-compete, under the current law, it simply used the phrase that the non-compete would only apply to a specified county, city, or part of either that then had to be identified. The new bill provides a more broader phrase, which is just, quote, a reasonable geographic area for a reasonable length of time. What that is unclear, and obviously that's going to be subject to some judicial interpretation, but the idea was that to not be so strict where people had to actually identify the specific county, city, in order to enforce a non-compete in the context of a sale of a business. It also, and maybe more importantly, explicitly expanded the exceptions application to limited liability companies and corporations, as well as partnerships. So, as I say here, partners and members and shareholders may now agree that any or all of them will not carry on similar businesses as part of an agreement to dissolve or disassociate from an entity. So, in other words, if one person were to leave a partnership in North Dakota, that person can be bound by a non-compete agreement, even if the partnership that they are leaving continues to operate. Whereas under the previous law, it appeared to be that the entire business had to be sold, and if just one person left, they arguably were still allowed to go off and compete, and the legislature has now decided that it didn't want to allow that, and that it would allow non-compete protection in the context of a partner leaving a business or selling off their interest. So I'm going to hand it over here to talk next about Massachusetts, but before I do, I'm going to give everybody the CLE code, probably the most important thing I've said in the last 25 minutes, but it is SS, that's S is in Sam, S is in Sam, 8398. Once again, SS8398. Thanks.
Thanks, Eric. We are going to move to the East Coast and talk about Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a significant new non-compete law that was passed. Massachusetts has been trying for a number of years to achieve non-compete reform, and they did that finally in October of 2018. A new law regulating non-competes went into effect, and this law limits enforceability and it codifies express requirements that must be met in non-compete agreements. It applies to both employees and independent contractors, but importantly, like some of the states Eric just talked about, the law only applies to non-compete agreements. So this will not affect your non-solicits, your non-disclosures, and your confidentiality provisions. Under Massachusetts' new law, non-competes will not be enforceable against employees who have been terminated without cause or laid off, non-exempt employees, undergraduate or graduate students who are working in an internship or short-term employment, and employees who are 18 years or younger. So we have four types of employees against whom non-competes are not enforceable. There is a caveat with respect to employees who have been terminated without cause or laid off, which we will talk about. But these are four pretty broad categories of employers against whom non-competes won't be enforceable. Now, for those employees who may be bound by a non-compete, there are a number of statutory requirements that must be complied with. And again, these are similar to some of the states that Eric just talked about. First, the non-compete must be in writing and it must be signed by both the employer and employee. So it's very important that we have good record keeping and that HR has a copy of the signed agreement containing the non-compete signed by both parties. Importantly, the non-compete provision must state that the employee had the right to consult with counsel prior to signing. They don't need to consult with counsel, but that language about the right to consult does need to be included. And then there's certain notice requirements. For an employee who's going to sign a non-compete at the beginning of employment, you must provide a copy of the agreement either before making a formal offer or 10 business days before the employee starts. whichever comes first. So in a lot of cases, it may be a good idea to include that non-compete agreement during the recruitment process, so the employee becomes aware, and then it does need to be given to them either 10 days before the employee starts or before making a formal offer. Then a lot of times we may enter into non-competes with employees midstream in employment. So they've been working there for a while, and for whatever reason you feel like this employee now needs a non-compete. Maybe they have been promoted or something like that, and they need to be bound by non-compete. This provision you must give notice of the agreement at least 10 business days before the agreement becomes effective. Importantly, for non-competes that are entered into in the middle of employment, there must be independent consideration beyond continued employment. So it's not enough that this person is just going to continue working for you. We need to give independent considerations such as a promotion or change in duties or a bonus or increase in pay, something like that, to establish independent consideration. The new law also codifies these traditional common law requirements that must be met, and Christine covered a couple of these during the introductory slides, but in Massachusetts, a non-compete cannot be any broader than necessary to protect a legitimate business interest. And a legitimate business interest in Massachusetts would be to protect your trade secrets, protect confidential information that would otherwise not qualify as a trade secret, or to protect goodwill. Massachusetts new law has time, geography, and activity restraints as well. Non-competes can only last for 1 year post-employment. Anything longer that will not be enforced. However, if the employee breaches his or her fiduciary duty, steals your property, violates some other non-disclosure or confidentiality agreement, the non-compete may be extended for an additional year, so that would be up to 2 years. Also, the non-compete needs to be reasonable in geographic scope and activity restrictions. So a non-compete will be presumed reasonable in scope if it's limited to the geographic areas where either the employee provided services or had a material presence or influence within the last 2 years of employment. So that's very important to make sure not only that the non-compete is narrowly tailored to protect a legitimate business interest, but also to make sure that the geographic scope is limited and that is limited in activity to the specific types of services the employee provided. And again, that's during the last 2 years of employment. So we have where the employee provided services, limited to the types of services provided, and a 1 year restriction. Massachusetts also has a significant garden leave provision, and Eric spoke about garden leave a few minutes ago. Massachusetts requires that a non-compete agreement include a garden leave clause or other mutually agreed upon consideration. Now, under the Massachusetts law, the garden leave clause requires that an employer pay an employee for the duration of the non-compete period at least 50% of that employee's highest salary in the last 2 years. And that obligation is only relieved if the employee breaches the agreement. This is significant. However, the law does provide that other mutually agreed upon consideration may be given instead of a garden leave clause. The problem is other mutually agreed upon consideration is not defined by the law. So it will be important, and we anticipate that this will be an area of this Massachusetts law that will be tested in the courts to determine what other mutually agreed upon consideration really means, given that this garden leave clause is significant. Additional considerations under Massachusetts. The law does not apply to non-compete agreements made in the sale of a business. So when owners are selling a business, there can be non-competes there, and that will not be affected. Christine touched on choice of law and venue provisions at the beginning of the webinar. Under the Massachusetts law, Massachusetts workers and employers cannot avoid the application of this new law by choosing another state's law or venue. Choice of law provisions and venue provisions, choosing a friendlier state, will not fly for Massachusetts workers and residents. And lastly, I touched upon this, separation agreements containing non-competes are not subject to this new law as long as the agreement provides that the employee has 7 business days to rescind acceptance. So, a practice pointer for employees who are laid off or terminated without cause. While non-competes, general non-competes, cannot be enforced with respect to those type of employees, you can enter into a severance agreement, and the severance agreement with laid off or employees who are terminated without cause can include a non-compete, so long as that employee has 7 days to rescind. So while this may mean that you're going to have to make present a severance package, or pay some sort of severance, you can still get a non-compete if that's important to you for that employee. And second practice pointer is the law, the Massachusetts law provides that courts can impose non-compete restrictions against employees who breach another provision of a contract, statute, or common law. So it's important to consider specifically providing in an employment agreement this judicial remedy, that in the event that an employee breaches a non-disclosure provision or a confidentiality agreement, that the court can enforce or enjoin a non-compete, even though you may not be able to otherwise enforce such a provision because the worker falls in one of those exempt categories. We're going to turn to Maine. Maine has an act now that applies to contracts entered into or renewed after September 18th, 2019. So this is coming up quickly. And this act does a number of things. First, it bars employers from entering into non-competes with lower wage employees. This is a theme that we're going to discuss with some of the other states, especially on the East Coast. Second, it limits the employer's ability to enforce non-competes. It mandates advanced disclosure. It imposes a time delay of when the non-compete goes into effect, and it prohibits no poach agreements. So we're going to go through each of these categories. Ban on non-competes with lower wage workers. Employers are barred from entering into non-compete agreements with employees who earn less than 400% of the federal property line. So for 2019, that's just under $50,000 for an individual. Now, because the income level is tied to the federal property line, which is subject to annual change, it's important for Maine employers to develop procedures to ensure ongoing compliance and to have a check in place to make sure that we are in compliance with whatever the annual federal property line is. Importantly, the Maine Act authorizes the Department of Labor to assess fines of $5,000 or more against employees who violate this provision. Now, that is regardless of whether the employee actually seeks to enforce the agreement. So it is very important that employers in Maine with Maine residents or workers comply with this prohibition of non-competes against low-wage employees. Next, Maine also codified just general common law limits on enforcement of non-competes. Again, like we just talked about in Massachusetts, non-competes will only be enforceable if they are reasonably and necessary to protect either trade secrets, confidential information that doesn't otherwise qualify as a trade secret, or goodwill. So it's important to think and figure out why we need a non-compete and why some other type of restrictive covenant like a non-solicit or non-disclosure will not protect us. Why is it that we need the non-compete to protect against or protect our legitimate business interests? Maine's Act also has specific disclosure requirements. Maine requires that an employer must disclose that acceptance of a non-compete agreement will be required prior to making an offer of employment. So this is important. Before you even offer a job to someone, you need to let them know that signing the non-compete is going to be required. So whether you do that in a job listing or very early in the recruiting process, it's just important to recognize this requirement and make sure that we comply. Second, an employer is required to provide an employee a written copy of the non-compete at least 3 business days before the employee is required to sign the agreement. Now, failure to provide either form of this advance notice is, again, punishable by a civil fine. So it's important to make sure that our protocol and what we're doing when entering into employment agreements with prospective employees in Maine fits with the statute and complies. Next, the Maine Act has, and this is somewhat unique, has a delayed effective date. So for the Act mandates a 6-month waiting period between when an employee enters into a non-compete agreement and when the non-compete obligations are binding on that employee. So for an existing employee who's entering into a non-compete midstream, the non-compete agreement will not be effective for the first 6 months after that existing employee signs the non-compete. Second, non-compete agreements are not binding on employees during the first year of employment. So there's essentially a 1-year grace period for new employees for them to decide to leave the employer before any non-compete can bind them. These rules merely affect whether the agreement is enforceable. The Department of Labor is not authorized to levy fines against employers if they have a non-compliant effective date. No poach clauses. Okay, so the Act also prohibits employers from entering into restrictive covenants with one another. This would be an agreement between 2 or more employers, which prohibits or restricts one of those employers from hiring another employer's employees. We see these provisions in franchise agreements and subcontractor agreements. That Act authorizes the Department of Labor to impose fines not only against employers who seek to enforce this type of provision, but also if an employer enters into this type of provision or threatens to enforce this type of provision. We're going to move on to Maryland. Maryland has less extensive changes, but they have a new non-compete law that's going into effect soon, again, in October of 2019. And this law bars employers from enforcing non-compete agreements against workers who are earning less than or equal to $15 an hour or just over $31,000 per year. We will see this in a couple other states like we just saw in Massachusetts. Importantly, this provision only applies to non-competes. It does not apply to non-disclosures, confidentiality, or non-solicits. So those are all still fair game regardless of how much the employee is making. And staying on the East Coast, New Hampshire also has a law effective September 2019 that restricts restrictive covenants for employers making less than or equal to 200% of the federal minimum wage. In 2019, that's $14.50 an hour or just over $30,000 annually. New Hampshire already has a law in place with certain notice requirements. For example, written copies of the non-competes must be provided prior to acceptance, but this low wage worker prohibition will come into effect shortly. And with that, we'll move on to Rhode Island.
Thanks, Kate. So I'm going to cover Rhode Island, and I think you probably are seeing the theme here. A lot of these revisions that are happening throughout the states are very similar, and it's, you know, these states are taking a step towards trying to limit, you know, the enforcement of non-competes. So Rhode Island is similar. In July of 2019, Rhode Island signed into law the Non-Competition Agreement Act. That act will take effect January 15th of 2020. It is important to note that this agreement or this act would not apply to independent contractors. It does not apply to non-competes entered into with respect to the sale of business, or similar to other states, you could enter into a severance agreement that contains a non-compete so long as you provide that employee that 7 days notice to or that 7 days to rescind acceptance if they so choose. And then it does not affect the enforcement of other types of contracts, such as non-solicitation, non-disclosure, and confidentiality agreements. That's similar to some of the other states we've been talking about. You still have the right to, you know, enter into the non-solicitation, non-disclosure, confidentiality agreements with your employees without being affected by this new act. You know, in addition, the act does not prevent a court from imposing a non-competition restriction on an employee that violates some other provision of the agreement or common law or statutory duties with respect to post-employment conduct. So, for instance, if you have evidence that an employee misappropriates trade secrets or violates the confidentiality obligations in some way, you could ask the court to then impose a non-competition restriction on that employee to protect your information from that specific employee using it improperly with its new employer or in some other way. So, you know, these are very similar restrictions to what we're already seeing. And I think, you know, it's important to note that what the takeaway from a lot of these is that, you know, courts are asking companies to look at whether or not they really need the non-compete. Can they protect their information? Can they protect their customer contacts with a non-solicit, with a non-disclosure, with confidentiality agreements, with these other more narrow restrictive covenants? So the Rhode Island Act, what does it prohibit? So again, we're seeing this movement towards not allowing non-competition restrictions on these low-wage earners. So for Rhode Island, that means earnings less than 250% of the federal poverty level for 2019, so that's about $31,000. It also restricts the use of non-compete agreements with undergraduate or graduate students in an internship or short-term employment relationship, non-exempt employees, or employees 18 years or younger. Unlike some of the other states, there is no grandfathering provision in the Rhode Island Act. So that means that agreements signed prior to January of 2020, January 15th, are still subject to the law. So it's important that any companies that have employees in Rhode Island or that are residents of Rhode Island that are signing these agreements, take a look at your agreements, because you will still be subject to these provisions even if the agreements were signed prior to 2020. So this is, for Rhode Island, the second time in the last few years that it's cracked down on non-compete agreements and narrowed its enforcement. In 2016, Rhode Island passed a law prohibiting non-competition language in most physician agreements. And it's important to note that you will see that restriction in various states with respect to physicians. Some states allow, you know, non-competes with respect to physicians. Some states prohibit it outright, and some states narrow it. We'll see in a minute another state that narrows it a bit. But, you know, the idea that if you're working with physicians that have non-competitions, you want to make sure you're looking at that specific state law with respect to that particular industry, because there are going to be variations there. Okay, so that brings us to kind of recent amendments. We're grouping Utah, Idaho, and Colorado together, not because they have similar amendments, but because these are kind of more minor amendments that have been happening recently. So Utah amended again its non-compete statutes in 2019. They originally amended in 2016, and Utah originally proposed an outright ban on non-competes. But as that bill made its way through to actually being enacted into law, it was scaled back quite a bit. And what Utah did in 2016 was it amended to not allow, you know, to put certain restrictions on what could be applied to or what non-competes could be enforced. It did not apply to severance agreements, and it did not prohibit other agreements. It did require an employer to pay attorney's fees and litigation costs if the covenants were found enforceable. But in 2018 and 2019, it made specific revisions to the broadcasting industry. It required a written contract of reasonable duration based on specific factors. So in 2018, it said that the broadcasting industry requirements had to be limited to no more than 4 years, and now it has revised again with respect to that specific industry that the contract needs to be of reasonable duration. And then it also says that an employee must be terminated for cause or has breached a contract resulting in termination, meaning that you can't enforce a non-compete in the broadcasting industry against an employee that you have terminated, and there's also a salary requirement there. In Idaho, it recently amended its non-compete law to put the burden of establishing irreparable harm back on the employers. Prior to this recent amendment, which was made in 2018, the employer had a rebuttable presumption of irreparable harm when enforcing its non-compete agreements, meaning that the employee had to prove that he or she had no ability to adversely affect an employer's legitimate business interests. And now in 2018, the change to the law is that rebuttable presumption was repealed, and the law places the burden back on the employer to establish irreparable harm before an injunction can be entered. So that's a small change, but can be significant when you're litigating these agreements, especially if you're going for a temporary restraining order or preliminary injunction against a former employee. Finally, in Colorado, there are recent amendments to its non-compete law regarding physicians, allowing physicians to continue treating patients with rare disorders without liability. So you can't enforce a non-compete in that situation. There is proposed legislation in Pennsylvania, Vermont, and New Jersey. Essentially, Pennsylvania and Vermont are looking for all-out bans. And New Jersey, a bill was introduced that would impose numerous restrictions on the enforceability of non-compete agreements, including limiting the term to 1 year and requiring garden leave. It's important to note that these proposed legislations don't appear to have any traction at this point, but these are states that are trying to pass legislation on non-competes, and so we should keep our eyes on them in the future. Okay, I'm going to flip it back to Kate really quick to talk about proposed federal legislation.
We just wanted to touch upon this briefly. There's no federal restrictions on non-compete agreements. However, in 2018, a bill was introduced by Senators Warren, Murphy, and others. It was the Workforce Mobility Act, and it sought to prohibit the use of non-competes nationwide. It did not affect non-disclosures. However, there was broad enforcement power for the Department of Labor under this act. The act failed to gain any traction and does not appear to be going anywhere. However, in January of 2019, Senator Rubio introduced the Freedom to Compete Act, and this sought to amend the Fair Labor Standards Act to ban non-competes against most non-exempt workers, and that is kind of a trend that we saw in some of the states that we talked about today, either the non-exempt workers or the low-wage employees. However, again, there's been no real traction for the Freedom to Compete Act. It may be that right now there doesn't seem to be any political appetite to address non-competes on the federal level, but regardless, this federal legislation is out there, and it's important to keep in mind and to follow.
Okay, so we are unfortunately out of time for questions, but we do have your questions that you guys have been submitting to us throughout this presentation, and we will gladly reach out to you individually and try to answer your questions as best we can. I think, as you can tell from our presentation, depends on the state, it depends on the situation, but we are happy to reach out to you individually and try to answer those questions or any other questions that you might have. On the screen is our contact information for Kate, Eric, and I. Please feel free to reach out to us if there's something else you want to know about this area of law, or if you have a specific question about your business and how you do things, and we would be happy to answer them for you. So thank you for joining us today. We appreciate you guys coming, and we hope you kind of take a look at our blogs and our trade secret information for Sifar Shah. And again, we hope you have a nice week.